So what the hell is going on in the presidential election? Who the bleep knows? As I'm sitting here on the back of the back stoop of the Chicago 3 flat, it's still all up in the air. Lawyers are sinking their teeth into this. Court challenges, Democrats shrieking, count all the votes, count all the votes, and Republicans shrieking, count all the legal votes, count the legal votes. You know, there is a difference. And with tens of thousands of Joe Biden votes found in the middle of the night in batches in Democratic states, I can't help but think of Jake Arvey, the West Side ward boss who rose up to run the Kelly Nash machine in Chicago. In 1936, his ward cast 26,112 votes for Franklin Delano Roosevelt's reelection, and only 974 votes for his opponent, Alf Landon. Roosevelt later clapped Jake Arvey, they called him Colonel Arvey, on the shoulder, and he called the 24th ward the number one ward in the entire Democratic Party. And you don't think he dined out on that? Let's say he didn't have to worry about being a poor man. He made it. He was made. So why wasn't it 26,000 votes to 3 or 2? Come on, man. No malarkey. It wouldn't look right. So what are we looking at now? That blue wave didn't happen. There was no blue wave. Forget all that AOC Kool-Aid. It didn't happen. The liberal media was repudiated. Pollsters, the coastal elites who let their hatred and their bias against blue-collar people, the ones who can't work on Zoom, blind them to the American reality. We're witnessing a reformation. The Republicans are becoming the Workers' Party. The Democrats are the elite party. And we'll talk all about this with the great Tom Bevin, co-founder of Real Clear Politics. But that repudiation of the blue liberal wave that didn't happen, I love saying that, had ripple effects in Illinois. It looks like we won't see a massive federal bailout of the failing tax and spend states, like Illinois that spent itself into the red forever. What does it mean for billionaire Governor J.B. Pritzker, who spent $58 million of his own cash to lose his so-called fair tax proposal on the Illinois ballot that was crushed by angry taxpayers? We're going to ask Tom Serafin of Serafin and Associates, host of the Crisis Cast podcast. And, you know, Pritzker is in a crisis now. Tom's my very good friend. And I think he's the richest man in the world, just like Jimmy Stewart. And it's in a wonderful life.
My big brother, George, the richest man in town.
Co-host Jeff Carlin is here, the newlywed and executive producer at WGN Radio. Jeff is the best producer in town. And I'm John Cass, husband, father, syndicated columnist of the Chicago Tribune, member of its editorial board. Yeah, the same editorial board that led the fight against the fair tax. And you, wondering how it's all going to turn out as the lawyers sink their teeth into it, as the plywood remains up on the downtown storefronts, as the liberal media licks its wounds and wonders why they missed what was going on in half the country. You know, because you're on the Chicago Way on WGN Plus.
Look, the Chicago Way is a deep cultural phenomenon.
It's the Chicago Way.
In a tower by the river, there lived a man.
Castle.
There was a man who took a stand with pen and paper in his hand defeating foes in every ward with a pen more mighty than the sword. No escape from his ink lasso in a tower by the river. Castle.
Here's how you get him. He pulls a knife, you pull a gun. He sends one of yours to the hospital, you send one of his to the morgue. That's the Chicago way.
You know, like I said, Tom Serafin is one of my dearest friends. He's got this great party every year before Christmas that everybody shows up. I got a hug from Lori Lightfoot and some of Bill Cellini's friends at this party. It was just fantastic. And he invites me, even though all these people don't like me, he likes me, and I'm glad to have him on the Chicago Way. Tom Serafin of Serafin and Associates.
Good day, John, and a very kind invite. You know, it's a Thanksgiving reception, and the season of Thanksgiving, you know, makes people do things they should be doing every day of the year. Gratitude is an important thing. It's very helpful to feel gratitude when you're in a mood of depression of some sort, and it's easy to be depressed in the year 2020. It's a difficult time for a lot of folks.
Tom Serafin, if you haven't seen it, you know that movie, It's a Wonderful Life, where at the end of it, the brother shows up and says to Jimmy Stewart, "You're the richest man in the world." And I have to say that that's a movie, but in reality, Tom Serafin is the richest man in the world because everybody loves this guy. I don't know. Right? I mean,
three things that always pop up, Tom Serafin, they always say, man, what a voice, what a party, and what a great guy. Every time you mention Tom's name in any situation.
Well, you guys are good for my ego, huh? On an early morning broadcast. You know, it's interesting you mentioned that movie, John, because we are currently filming an adaption of that movie in Western Springs for the Western Springs Theater. You know, the theater is closed, and we're trying to keep all the actives and the scores and scores of students that are going to the theater school all the time. So we decided to do a movie, and I've been cast as Uncle Billy, and we are shooting scenes all through November, and it will be released and available online in the month of December.
It's an updated version. Who's Mr. Potter? Who's Mr. Potter? I would have loved to have been Mr. Potter.
Well,
you eaters and eaters and producers, like Pate Phillips said, and you're eaters.
That's right. Pate Phillips used to use that term all the time. Right. So it's interesting you mentioned that movie.
Let's get back to somebody who, you know, one thing you also should know is that Tom Serafin is the host of the Crisis Cast, which is his podcast with Lisa Drews. And you know why he calls it that? Because Tom is a crisis manager. Okay, so if something bad happens to you, you got to call him, and he'll I know, I've done it. You manage the crisis. But Tom, if you were a rich guy, like billionaire, okay, multi-gajillionaire, and you had all your money in the Grand Cayman Islands, and your wife likes to go watch your daughter jump horses in Florida, and you're really, really, really rich, and you're also governor, and you just spent $58 million of your own money to try to convince people to raise the income tax, and you failed. Now you got to cut. Has Governor Pritzker called you and said, "Tom, I'm in a crisis. I don't know what to do"? What would you do, Tom?
Well, actually, the defeat opens the door for him wider than it was before the situation. You know, historically, the past a controversial referendum like this one was is very difficult. The 60% is a huge lift. I worked on the Education Amendment referendum in 92, and the opposition got 57%. They needed 60%. It's a large lift. But, you know, if you win an election 57-43 or 55-45, that's a great victory. But when you're trying to put a referendum on the ballot, it doesn't work that way. And the 1970 Constitution, the people who wrote that thing and worked hard on it, and you know, I think the speaker was part of that group. There were a lot of interesting people. A lot of Don Clark Netsch was part of that group, a famous senator who ran for governor back in 94, who wanted to do a tax swap. And eventually Edgar picked up the tax swap idea. But it's a very difficult thing to do. 60%. So now the door is open. The world is his oyster. He has every right to call the caucuses into his office, meet with them, talk about what painful measures they need to take to cut the budget and to raise revenue. They're going to raise revenue. They're going to be a tax increase I think the lame duck session in the second week of January, it's going to be there. They're going to present something. That's the perfect time to do it. I would be very surprised if they take advantage of that opportunity, 20% or whatever the number is going to be. But there's a lot of other cost-cutting measures they need to take, and they need to take a real good scalpel to the cost of government. And with the situation with Justice Kilbride in the Supreme Court, Democratic majority of 4-3, depending on how things work out between now and 22. Could go the other way, which would give them an opening to do something to bring the pension laws into kind of concert the way we are currently with our economic outlook on life. So there's opportunity there, and he can take it. This should be a catalyst for him. And yesterday, I thought his news conference, he was blistering. I thought he was blistering in his ferocity, but he needs to take that same attitude into the legislative conference rooms and start talking to his colleagues in the House and the Senate.
That's the trouble with him. He does have an opportunity, but he's going to have to, if he's going to think he's going to blister Democrats or even Democrats and Republicans whose counties in this last week, voted overwhelmingly against his tax, he's going to have a problem. I mean, he can't blister people. He's got to, talk to them, bring them all together. Talk.
Well, the only surprise in the outcome, I never thought it had a prayer to get 60%, but I thought it would get 50, 55, somewhere in there. I thought he'd do better than 50%. Latest numbers I've seen is that they weren't able to reach 50%, 45, 46, 47, somewhere in there, depending on the latest vote count. That's less than half of the people that voted. That's a terrible outcome on a situation where you needed 60%. So it makes it harder sell, obviously. But they're going to have to go in, and they're going to have to do the tough things right now. And if he allows this thing to get farther away from the incident of this election, the more time that is wasted, or the more air you put between what happened this week and the next decision, it's going to be more and more problematic for him. He needs to act quickly. He needs to be decisive, and they need to take action sometime between now and February 1st. I think they will, because they have to.
But as Jeff Carlin would tell you, the action that he has to take includes hurting his own constituency. And that means he's got to take some kind of action on payroll, some kind of action on pensions. He's got to do something.
He's got to put the package together, take it off his desk, and put it squarely in the heart of the House of Representatives where the budget process starts. And he's got to take the Senate Democrats, who are in strong force today, he's got to get them activated. And the Black Caucus is playing a very a big role in the city of Springfield right now, and they could be a key selling point. And the reason that you just mentioned his constituency is very important, because the sooner he acts, the more room there is between him and the next election. If he waits and this thing has to go through June and then into the veto session of 21, he goes right into the election cycle. Well, he is in the election cycle right now, but he goes right into the election cycle carrying all those wounds of this process. They have to get it done early. They got to take the pain now and then move on and be more constructive and really get this state back on it. And you know what? The state's economy is such, John, that he has no choice. I mean, you have to attend to this thing now, because we're getting to the point where we're going to be past the point of no return. economically.
The irony in all of it is that as bad as these cuts are and as needed as they are, they're not going to even come close to addressing the real issues in the state with everything from the glut of our governmental institutions that cost a fortune to run to the pension issues that should have been addressed first. So it can do all they want and cut services and hurt people, but it's really going to do nothing to fix our real problems. At least in my
opinion. I think they have to address the pension issue. And when it comes to re-election, if the pension issue hasn't been addressed, then the incumbents in the next election cycle will be in trouble, more so than any other time in my lifetime, because the pressing problems of the state's economy and its distressed state cannot be right now, based on the outcome in the United States Senate, cannot be relieved by expecting the federal government to bail them out. And it's not going to be relieved because the amendment, it wasn't going to be a bailout. It was going to be a tourniquet. They needed still to address the situation more seriously. So I really do believe we are at the end of the line, and the next election cycle will prove that. I know they're going to be dealing with a new map, and they're going to be focusing on carving the state up again. The census indicates we're going to lose at least one, maybe two congressional seats. I understand that's what they're going to be focusing on. But if they don't focus on the business at hand, people won't be eating and people won't be voting.
That brings us to the other thing, which is you've got Kilbride, Madigan's judge on the Supreme Court, losing. And a remap of the state looming. What is going to happen there, Tom?
Well, you know, that's another mess. Last time, I think it was Pat Quinn's effort, 600,000 signatures were gathered to put together a fair map, a remap strategy, and it went to the Supreme Court. Frank Clark and John Hooker, I think it was, from Commonwealth Edison, and those guys, they filed a lawsuit, and by a ruling of 4-3, I think Kilbride might have been the deciding vote and written the opinion. They decided that they could not go on the ballot, despite the gathering of 600,000 Illinois signatures. They kept it off the ballot because the outcome is pretty obvious. What would happen? People would vote for a fair map, would vote for an opportunity to be equally represented all over the state of Illinois. So that may switch, but I don't think that new person takes the seat till 22. So there will be litigation over it, but it depends on who's going to take that Kilbride seat. And that's very important to watch. But it's unfortunate that the state's economic balance rests in the idea that the Supreme Court could be not balanced based on politics. I understand that's the game, but it's not the way it should be.
Well, politics is part of how Illinois expresses itself. Hey Tom, I and Jeff, I put out on Facebook last night right before I fell asleep. I was just running on fumes, and Kristen helped me out, gave me an idea about a column on Kim Fox and independent judiciary, and I got through it and then fell asleep. But I put up on Facebook questions, asking people who listen to the Chicago Way, do you have any questions for Tom Serafin and Tom Bevin? And I put it up there, and there were so many responses, I can't read them all, but I got to read one. And this is from Joe Melez, okay? Here's the question. So how soon until the federal bailout of Illinois? And where's mine?
McConnell, if he continues to hold on to the Senate, as they're still counting votes, right, and it appears as he will at least have a two-vote margin, where he had a four-vote margin, he's got a two-vote margin. I don't think, despite his relationship and collegial relationship over the years with Joe Biden, probably the next president of the United States, I don't see a bailout for the state of Illinois. I don't see it politically because of the party issues, but I don't see it from his attitude. I'm not going to bail states out that are really responsible for their own mess and exactly haven't shown any effort to pick up the mess and clean it up themselves. So I know the president of the Illinois Senate sent a note a few months ago asking for 40.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't think. I think that was a good gesture and probably the right thing to do, but I don't see it happening.
But I've got to ask before we close out. Sorry, Jeff. I just have to ask this one thing because I talk to Tom regularly, and I called him the other day because we were talking about bailout and the possibility that the Senate stays Republican despite the so-called blue wave that never happened. And it affects somebody that Tom's known for maybe 40 years and me maybe about 35. He likes Tom and he hates me. His name is Senator Dick Durbin, and I'm just wondering, you know, when is if Dick Durbin, if the Republicans don't take the Democrats don't take the Senate, Dick Durbin, in my view, was betrayed by weaselly Chucky Schumer years ago. Dick should have been the Senate Majority Leader. Now he was betrayed and stabbed in the back. That's my view, not anyone else's, and. I mean, anyone else can is welcome to have it, but I'm just saying what I think. And now, if it doesn't go Democrat, won't Dick Durbin and Joe Biden's the Republican? Joe Biden's the president. Won't Joe do his friend Dick a solid and maybe let him become ambassador of Lithuania or something? You know, just go out there and be. Because Vilnius is beautiful this time of year, I hear.
Mm-hmm. No? I think he probably being in the minority in any particular body is really difficult to sit around and be reactive rather than proactive and being on the offense all the time. And you can do that strategically, but it's difficult when you don't have the gavel. And Senator Durbin has paid all his dues, having been elected to the House of Representatives in '92, and now being in the Senate for several terms. I think you know he's a terrific international scholar, and he'd be terrific as an ambassador to France or something. But you know, being number behind Schumer in the U.S. Senate, I with all due respect to Mr. Schumer, Dick Durbin's got a lot more smarts than Chuck Schumer does. He should be the minority leader of the U.S. Senate. And I thought it was impressive. You know, he was on the Chicago Tonight WTTW show this week. And he said he was very disappointed with Mike Madigan. I'm paraphrasing, but he said Mike Madigan cost a lot of offices in Illinois. And he actually was, you know, he was smart and he sounded right, and he was aggressive, and I was surprised that the way he went about and speaking about that issue inside the party. Usually you deal with those issues, you know, behind closed doors, but he was critical of the behavior of the speaker and the number of political offices that were lost because of his behavior. And he said he was hoping the speaker took it to heart. I think probably you're going to see a lot more active, vocal U.S. Senator. I don't think, though, he serves out his term. I think eventually he's going to get tired of the routine and he'll probably be appointed something or, you know, something will happen that will move him to another office where he can probably do more good than sitting behind Chuck Schumer.
I agree. And I think maybe he might like a France or Spain. And they might like him.
Oh, he'd be terrific at it. He's terrific at it. He used to be the parliamentarian in the Illinois Senate back in the 70s. That's where I first met him when I was a reporter. As a human being, just one of the nicest guys in the world. I mean, and then he has to be in the swamp, too, which makes it very difficult.
And he can, with that reasonable voice of his, when he speaks reasonably and he's cutting your throat. He is just so good at rhetoric. I mean, you have to I just tip my hat to the guy, 40 years survival in this game. Man. Anyway, you are the richest man in the world, Tom Serafin. I can't wait to see you in that movie in the Western Springs Theater, right. My old neighborhood.
Yes.
Now I'm sitting in this damn 3-flat on the porch. It's so depressing. All right, Tom, say hi to Ann and everybody at Serafin Associates, and we'll talk to you soon.
Well, God bless you all, you know, and Jeff, thank you very much. You all stay well, and it's tough for everybody in this day and age with the COVID, but, you know, please take care of yourself, and everybody out there listening, take care of yourself.
We love you, man. See you.
Thanks, love you, Tom. Too, guys. Thank you.
Be peace. Well.
Peace.
I wish I had somebody to help me sing this.
So this is the Chicago Way. Tom Bevin's on the phone, and now I have like the three people who even want to talk to me anymore. Tom Bevin, Jeff Carlin, and Tom Serafin. Tom Bevin of Real Clear Politics, I just tweeted something that I thought was the most astounding takedown in the history of Twitter takedowns.
Well, I'm pretty sure that's not true, but go ahead.
This is the one where you respond to the snarky New York Times people who are trying to rip on Real Clear. And I said, I hate to quote myself. I only do that, you know, quote myself subtly, but not really. Not loud. The best counterpunch in journalism, Tom Bevin, RCP, responds to New York Times snark about Real Clear poll averages this way. And then he has the tweet. You can find it, you know, Tom Bevin RCP or me, John at John_cast. He rips the New York Times Siena poll rated 8+ by Pulse by 538, overestimating Biden's support, +6 in Florida, +4 in North Carolina. Biden's support overestimated probably 6-ish in Michigan when the count is in, 10-ish in Wisconsin, 10+ in Iowa. Remember that? The Siena poll saying Biden was going to crush Trump in Iowa by 11, 12 points, whatever it was. 9+ in Ohio. Tom, I just want to say my hat. I tip my hat to you, sir. And I watched it on Laura the other night, Laura Ingman the other night. You were just, that was just a way to go, way to defend Real Clear Politics. One of my favorite
You websites. Know, I, listen, I typically turn the other cheek about this kind of stuff, and I don't like to get involved in food fights with, you know, other folks who are doing what we do. We don't go after Nate Silver publicly very often about, you know, problems with his methodology, or we could nitpick a bunch of stuff that he does. We don't do that. You know, but the New York Times came out ahead of time, ahead of the election, Nate Cohn, and basically tried to discredit us and saying, oh, you know, the Real Clear Politics averages and, you know, we don't know what they're doing. And they're more, you know, basically because we included a bunch of late polls from pollsters that, I mean, here's the thing. There's a lot that's going on right now in you're seeing a lot of folks saying polling's done and all of this. There were two sets of pollsters this time, right?
There you go.
There were the more quote unquote Trump friendly pollsters, right?
You were criticized for discussing.
Right. You know, Trafalgar, Robert Cahalia, Trafalgar, right. Susquehanna, Insider Advantage. And those folks showed this a pretty close race. And they showed Donald Trump doing very well in some states, right? And mm-hmm. and those are the polls that, you know, the Nate Silvers and Nate Cohns of the world give like C+, C-, D ratings and discount them, marginalize them, ridicule them. Mm-hmm. And it was the mainstream media polls that are the ones that are done by, you know, the sort of left-wing academics, right? Siena College, right. Quinnipiac, that just
right.
got this so freaking wrong that, you know, so I'm tired of it. I just am fed up with it. And there has to be accountability for this stuff. And they can't just like, you know, this is not some sort of hit and run where you just leave the scene of the accident and pretend like it didn't happen, right?
So we're going to do more of this, I think, in terms of analysis of, once the votes come in, and we'll see where they all shake out. But I do think it is important to hold people accountable. And we were assured 4 years ago that the pollsters would, the media folks would figure it out, and they would return with, humility and all of this stuff. And it just never happened. I mean, again, the fact that Joe Biden may barely win this election, and I don't know that, he may.
Right.
Well, yeah, I mean, we'll see how it works out. But does not exonerate, the Economist for their, 93% Joe Biden odds of winning, right? Or Nate Silver, any of these other folks for suggesting in, many, many ways that this was going to be the blue wave, the blowout. It's not going to be particularly close because of, how many think pieces do we read, right? And I said this on Laura last night about, why 2020 is not 2016, right? We have all this district polling that's not showing any movement to Trump. He's the incumbent. We have, COVID. We have all these things. And so, again, it was the media taking these polls and plugging them into their preconceived bias and narrative against Donald Trump and why he, shouldn't be reelected or couldn't be reelected or whatever the case may be. And I just think, that has to – We have to talk about that. We have to account for it.
This is going on all over media now where I see the hand-wringing. This is something that listeners to the Chicago Way, readers of Real Clear Politics and of my column, have been talking about and learning about for 6 years or 4 years, which is that in 2016, we got it. A lot of them got it wrong. I didn't get it wrong. Tom Bevin didn't get it wrong. But many got it wrong. And the reason why they got it wrong is because they don't understand or think about anyone outside their coastal elite bubbles. They can't even imagine that people, Americans, have different views. Or if they do, they're somehow cult members. Or I can smell them in Walmart or whatever they say. And this arrogance is dangerous on two levels, Tom. And I'd like you to respond. The first level, obviously, is they put half the country in the box. They kick them into the corner. That all that stuff about their cults and their stupid cultists and all that, that's like jabbing a dog with a stick in the corner. And sooner or later, if that dog has any gumption, the dog's going to jump out of that corner and come after that stick. That's number one. Number two, at a time of crisis, like now, I wouldn't say crisis, but confusion, COVID, the election, the phantom votes found and all that, people screaming on all sides. It's the time when you need media that is responsible and not given to allowing their own prejudices to color their judgment. It's critical. And I see that. Failing throughout in this no blue wave thing.
Right. Well, I agree with that. I mean, there are two things. I mean, if we want to stay focused on the media for a second, I will say, that's not going to change. I mean, does anybody think that, Jake Tapper and George Stephanopoulos and Don Lemon and Rachel Maddow are just going to walk off the set and no longer do what they do? I mean, they are the ones who, is the New York Times newsroom going to change suddenly overnight or the Chicago Tribune newsroom? I mean,
speaking of someone who was almost woke to death. Yeah. Right.
Yeah. Exactly. So that attitude is not going to change. Now, listen, we're going to find out two things about the media. Number one, we're going to find out if Donald Trump does not win this election, right? We're going to find out, number one, how the level of Trump derangement that's gone on in this country, is it a bacterial infection, right, or a virus? Is it something that's going to go away you know, or is it something that's going to continue? And then the second piece of that is, you know, watching how the media responds to a President Joe Biden and his administration. Are they going to treat him the same way they treated Trump? Are they going to investigate him in the same way? Are they going to be as adversarial toward him? I don't think anybody thinks that that's going to remotely be the case, but we'll see what their actions are. But as far as the election is concerned, you know, I do think, and I've been saying this for months, right? That both sides, I think both campaigns have gone about sort of seeding the ground to undermine the integrity of the process, right? Trump's saying all the time, it's, you know, massive fraud and ballots everywhere. And right. Sometimes he's glomming onto a news story out of Wisconsin or something. And sometimes he's making it up, you know, and then you got Joe Biden saying things like, the only way I can lose is if there's chicanery at the polls. I mean, James Clyburn said it the other day.
Right.
You've got Democrats coming up with these bizarre conspiracy theories that Republicans are ripping mailboxes out of the ground and shipping them away to, you know, I mean, so
remember that. Yeah.
So both sides have done it. And so here we are now, and we've got, you know, a bunch of close states coming down to the final counts. And once again, look, democracy is messy. And we found that out in 2000, when you get down and start looking at how the sausage is made with these people handling the ballots and hanging chads, it's not pretty, right? And so you see this stuff happening, and both sides are already on edge. And, you know, Democrats are, you know, we've got to investigate the USPS because they didn't, you know, they didn't, their 30,000 or whatever, however many, all these postal, you know, centers that needed to be swept for ballots, and because, you know, Republicans are trying to suppress the vote. And then you've got, you know, Republicans are like, believe that Democrats are trying to, you know, they go to bed one night, they wake up the next morning, and Donald Trump's 110,000 vote lead has turned into a deficit in Wisconsin because Milwaukee tallied 169,000 votes, right? You might have to change the name of this podcast to the Milwaukee way, John. So look, I mean, so both sides are ginned up. And now we're down digging in the dirt, and it's ugly. And half the country is going to walk away feeling like this thing was stolen, one way or the other. I mean, if Trump manages to somehow hold on in Georgia, North Carolina, hold on in Pennsylvania, and reclaim Arizona, I mean, Democrats are going to lose their marbles.
That's why they boarded up downtown, not for the they weren't worried about the Rotarians coming down from Wheaton.
Right, exactly.
Right.
There's going to be a looting at the Brooks Brothers on Michigan Avenue, right?
The Oddfellows Hall has erupted in flames. Yes.
Bow ties for everybody.
Right.
So look, I do think, and you layer on top of that, to your point, John, sort of tying this all together, a media that has been lost a lot of credibility over the way that they've, you know, conducted themselves over the last 4 years, and it's a recipe for disaster. I mean, it really is.
Not examining the prejudices. That's the first thing that an editor tries to train a reporter to do. Explain or understand where your own prejudices might get in the way of seeing clearly. And so I would give you an example, the Russia collusion thing, our Real Clear Politics, anybody listening, go on that site, read my column first, then go on that site. Sometimes it's there. You have to read it. I mean, if you don't read Real Clear Politics, you're not informing yourself, because they have pieces from the left and the right. But in the Real Clear Politics analyses over time, you got a sense that there was no interest for the New York Times and the Washington Post to use the iconic titles, you know, those publications, to walk back the cat and find out how they too were manipulated in all this Russia stuff, Russia hoax stuff. There was no interest, no curiosity whatsoever, because I guess what they would have to give back the return their Pulitzer prizes for it. I don't know. And that's, you know, really distressing.
So Carl Cannon and I were just having a conversation And it was, you know, we were sort of joking because Carl said, look, you know, Trump's alleging all this fraud in the, you know, talking about Pennsylvania specifically. And he said, you know, they've got to produce results. They've got to produce evidence. And I said to Carl, I said, can you prove that fraud's not going on? And he said, that's not the way this works. And I said, that's not how the media's been operating for 4 years. Right. Like this dossier, parts of it, you know, it hasn't, have not been verified. It's unverified. Please verify it for me. Otherwise I'm going to believe it. And so, right. And I'm half joking with that analogy because the standard that the media has set up and pursued is, you know, we're going to assume these allegations against you unless and until you can prove them false to me. They did that with Brett Kavanaugh. They did it with Trump and using, you know, single anonymously sourced reports. I mean, all sorts of craziness. So I think the media has really got themselves in a, you know, they've got themselves in a pickle over the way that they've covered Trump. And it'll be interesting to see how they handle themselves moving forward if Trump is no longer on the scene and it's President Joe Biden.
It should be interesting to see if President Joe Biden, who quickly tries to become, to me, and this is not popular among many of my colleagues in the woke newsroom of the Chicago Tribune or journalism elsewhere, but Joe Biden is the cynical part of this. And the Republicans are cynical as well. But the cynical part on the Democratic side is offering up this husk. You call it Joe Biden. It's not Joe Biden. I remember Joe Biden from 85. I remember him peeling Clarence Thomas in the Judiciary Committee. This is not the same Joe Biden. So he's just a husk there, out there to allow for the endorsement of Wall Street, the big Wall Street money coming into the Democratic Party to allow big tech to protect Joe Biden and then thus Twitter and Facebook coalesce around the Democrats. He's just like a puppet out there. I'm not trying to be against the man personally. I'm just saying what it is. And when he goes sooner or later, I'm just wondering what happens.
Well, I think we're, you know, look, the Democrats have said, and the never Trump Republicans, and, you know, there are a lot of folks who believe that Joe Biden is where his heart really is that he's a compromiser. He's a centrist. He works across the aisle, you know, all that stuff. And we will find out. I mean, his actions are going to tell us whether he is a husk and a puppet or whether he is actually, in fact, you know, is he going to appoint some Republicans to his cabinet? Who might those people be? How's he going to approach, you know, Mitch McConnell in the Senate? If they try and, you know, they're going to want to get stuff done. They're going to want to legislate. Nancy Pelosi's got a slimmer majority in the House. So, you know, perhaps the constraints of Congress will force Joe Biden to embrace his moderate instincts. That's not going to make the squad happy. And they all got reelected and are raring to go. So it's going to be interesting to see if he does, in fact, win this election, how he governs. Does he govern as a centrist or does he govern as just sort of a you know, moderate facade for a massively progressive, you know, administration and policy. So we'll see. But the proof will end up being in the pudding, and I will reserve my judgment until I see what he does or does not do.
And that's presupposing that he is the president. I caveated
that by saying if he wins this election, because I don't think it's over yet.
No,
I think Trump's down to his last, you know, couple cards in his hand that he's got to play here, and they got to come up winners or he will lose this election, but we'll see.
Do you guys, both of you, do you think that for some reason, do you think any way, shape or form that Donald Trump is like Richard Nixon, and after Chicago, after Texas, he decided, oh, I'll just step down because I'm not going to get like this, like this? I mean, the mistake that they make is thinking this guy's not going to fight like a cat under the porch, you know, dying, you know, like a dying cat under your porch. Those things fight till even after they're dead.
Yeah. But where does he go? I mean, he's going to be, I don't know. I've had lost some sleep over just thinking about what the next, between now and January, what he's going to be like. Cause it's going to, and because we have to cover it and then follow it. And it's just part of this 24-hour news cycle that's just ruining everything, in my opinion. I mean, you're right, John. It's going to be like a Trump we've never seen before, and Trump at a new level. And he's really good at being him.
Look, he's going to fight the way, because look, I mean, Tom, all this stuff coming, what about these ballots coming in late at night in Philadelphia, like 23,000 to zero? Isn't that like Chicago that's Chicago. That's like the Johnny Bracco, like count them again, you know, like in Key Largo, or there was a fellow named Jake Arby, Colonel Jack Arby. His precincts for Roosevelt would come in 833 to 2. And they was asking why the 2, and he said, oh, I had to give them 2 so they wouldn't look bad.
Listen, how about this? All right. If Donald Trump loses this election, and it's close, and you know, his supporters feel like it was stolen from him. I don't know that Donald Trump's good. I would not be surprised if the first thing that Donald Trump does is file for re-election to run for president 4 years from now, and just spend the next 4 years right in Joe Biden and the Democrats' face, and you know, keeping, he's 74 years old. He'd be 78. That's what Joe Biden is right now. I don't think anybody thinks Donald Trump is, you know, isn't energetic after what he just did. Oh, has the strength and stamina to you know, run a campaign. I would not rule that out. I mean, I don't know that he's going to just walk away. I think the media would like him to walk away, and certainly the Democrats would. I think if he's just sitting on the sideline and, you know, sending out tweets, they'll just ignore them. Whereas for 4 years, they couldn't ignore anything he tweeted. They'll just ignore him. But if he says this was a fraud of the American people, I don't care how long it takes. I'm going to run again in 4 years, and I'm starting right now. Then they can't really ignore him, and the Republican Party can't ignore him. And, you know, at this point, who knows with Donald Trump? He hates to lose. We know that. He does hold grudges, and this might be the ultimate grudge.
At least he holds grudges publicly, unlike so many of us. Like, I try to, if I hold a grudge, I pretend I don't hold one, you know, but I do. And we'll see what happens.
You can file that prediction, Cass, right next to my Michelle Obama prediction that I made the day after the election 4 years ago.
I still haven't cashed in on that one, man.
Cashed in on it. I owe
also,
you.
Also, Bevan, the third one is, hey, John, John Cass is running for mayor of Chicago, and I'll be back at him, Tom Bevan said. Yeah, that worked out. Tom Bevan. I loved it how you fought for yourself. It was good. It was like a double left hook and a right hand. It was perfect.
I'm left-handed, though, so maybe the other way around.
Tom Bevan of Real Clear Politics, a man who can counterpunch, our friend. Thanks for being here on the Chicago Wing.
Thanks, Tom.
Yep.
See you, buddy.
Hey, John.
You're awesome. Yeah, you are just
I superb. Think you need to change the name of your – of your podcast.
To what? The Wisconsin Way?
No, I was joking about that. Just the podcast. K-A-S-S.
Really? Is that like a marketing thing?
Maybe I don't know. I was just upstairs telling my wife, I'm like, I got to go do a podcast with Cass. And I'm like, what? You should call it a podcast.
Yeah, right. That puts my name in it.
Exactly.
The Chicago Way podcast. I like
as
it.
Opposed to the as opposed to like the Carlin, the pod Carlin, whatever.
the pod Carlin. I love it.
Yeah. All right, guys. Love you. See you, man. Bye. Yes, it was a tale of two Toms, one with an H. For Tom Serafin, my friend and host of the Crisis Cast podcast, and also founder of Serafin and Associates, and the guy who's been in all the smoky back rooms of Illinois and doesn't smoke. And for Tom Bevan, our other friend, founder and publisher of the RealClearPolitics.com website and empire, and a man who fights for his own reputation, and I like that. And for Jeff Carlin, executive producer at WGN Radio, and for me, John Cass, husband, father, nationally syndicated columnist, the Chicago Tribune, a member of its editorial board. And you, with all that's going on, a country divided in half, waiting for that blue wave that never came, you're on the Chicago way. Thanks for being here, everybody. Talk to you again.